Thank you so much, Kirk, for your warm introduction and for your heartfelt invitation to come here. And I'm very happy. It's really a great evening for me to be able to be with you and to spend this evening and to have the opportunity to speak about existential access, humanism, to make the bridge from Freud to Frankl to the new developments, the phenomenological developments which we made, and to share all this. And hopefully tomorrow, and certainly tomorrow, we will have great opportunities to talk more. And whenever you have a question while I'm speaking, please feel free to interrupt, to ask me. We are a small audience, we can communicate very easily. So you are welcome to bring up your questions, and this makes it more lively, I think. And by the way, I bring you a lot of PowerPoint slides, and you don't have to copy them, because you can find them on my homepage. They are already there, you can download them, and then you may even take a leave and go with your memories and thoughts wherever they lead you while I'm speaking, and you will not be lost because you have the summary afterwards. I come from Vienna. This is the courtyard of the University of Vienna, and here there are famous physicians, and in the very angle is the bust of Sigmund Freud. There is no bust of Frankl, there is no bust of Rollo May, of course. And maybe one day we will have one of Kirk Schneider. In Vienna started psychotherapy with Sigmund Freud, who had a good idea, I would say a humanistic idea. He said that we should try to make an improvement of that what is the it, the non-personal, to make it an I. A very famous phrase of Sigmund Freud, where it was, shall I be. It is the impersonal, the psychodynamic, the not worked through. And his idea was to make the human being more human. Human beings are animals. We have all of the animals in us. But to make them more human, they should become I. But the big question is, who is I? What would you say? What is the I? What makes me human? What is the characteristic of a human being? Of course, you are existential humanistic. You would possibly say reflection, or feeling, or authenticity, or being able to be present. Also, Freud at this time, in the end of the 19th century, he was a child of the Enlightenment period. And as such, for him, what makes the human being human was consciousness. The I is the consciousness. So his motto was to make conscious what is unconscious. And he put himself into the tradition of natural science, which started with physics, with Galileo Galilei, who said we should measure what is measurable and we should make measurable what is not yet measurable. He wanted to make a physics of the human being in the tradition of the upcoming, the upraising natural science and physics as the main leading form of natural science. He didn't want to be a humanist. He didn't want to bring in philosophy, he wanted to make measurable. This was in the tradition of the medical school of Vienna, who made very much measurable at the time in the 19th century. And this made the medical school great. It was the leading medical school in the world at the end of the 19th century. I would say, instead of consciousness, if we go a bit away from the period of enlightenment, we could use the term awareness, maybe mindfulness. Today, I think Freud would have said, to make us more aware of ourselves, of what we do, to be more mindful. But at that time, this was the great step. He brought into psychology the idea of rationality, consciousness, and with the aim to make the human being more human. So we can say, we can claim, Freud was already the first humanist. I would be curious what he would answer to if he were here. But I think you would agree. Yeah? This is the house, Berggasse 19 in Vienna, where he lived. From Freud, we come to Frankl. Frankl, as a high schooler, was in connection with Sigmund Freud, and he wrote him dozens of letters. Whenever he found something which was valuable for psychoanalysis, he sent it to Freud, and Freud answered all of his letters to a high schooler, imagine. Freud wrote 7 letters per day in the statistics of his life, divided by the days of his life. But not emails. Frankl wanted to become a psychoanalyst. He decided not. He became an Adlerian. And then he was even thrown out by the Adlerians. And at that time, when he wanted to become a psychoanalyst, he wrote a paper on psychoanalysis. And he sent it to Sigmund Freud. The paper was titled On the Mimic Approval and Denial of the Human Being. And the idea was, it's only 3 pages, printed pages. The idea was, when the human being says yes, this means coitus. And no is a denial of coitus. So he connected the gesture, the human gesture, with the libidinal theory of Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud answered him, you won't be against that I will send this paper to the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, where it was published in the year 1926. At that time, Frankl already was with Alfred Adler. But his first publication was a psychoanalytic publication. Frankl liked to tell a story about his relationship to Sigmund Freud. In the late 20s, Frankl was in Vienna passing around the Votivkirche, and then he saw a man with a cylinder hat and a stick and a dark long coat walking on the street, and then he thought, this could be Sigmund Freud. He never saw him in person so far. And then he saw that this man bent the curve and went into Berggasse, then he said, for sure, this must be Sigmund Freud. And he ran up to him, stood up in front of him and said, do I have the honor to meet Sigmund Freud? The man stood up and said, yes, this I am. And he said, my name is Viktor Frankl. And Sigmund Freud interrupted him and said, wait a minute, you live in Janingasse 6, door 22. He had in memory the address years after his their correspondence, in memory the address of Viktor Frankl. And then they talked a little bit. A person who has such a memory must develop a psychology of memory, I think. When you can't forget, what do you do with your life? You must develop that more. Frankl, brought up into depth psychology the idea to bring contents into the life. He was one of the founders of humanistic psychology. He said, people are looking for meaning. They are not happy enough or happy or with or content with just having fulfilled their drives. They want to understand why they are living and especially why they have to suffer. And so he brought up the idea that on the top of Sigmund Freud's, as what Frankl called in Nietzschean terms, will to pleasure, and on the top of the Adlerian will to power, there is the will to meaning. And both other motivations become poignant only when the will to meaning is frustrated. This was his idea, and he called it logotherapy. Well, Frankl also lived in Vienna, and we can see here.
That's not Frankl.
But that's a person who has some good bridges and connections to the existential aspect of Frankl. Frankl lived in the third floor up here. Here you see it from the side a bit more. I would like to bring you now some contents to speak a little bit about logotherapy, to show the development and how we went over to existential analysis and then to speak about the contents of existential analysis. You heard already Frankl, his major work with which he was world-renowned was Man's Search for Meaning, his experience in death camp. He developed a philosophical concept of the human being, an anthropology, and on the basis of Max Scheler, and named his practice logotherapy. Logos means meaning in Greek, word, but also meaning. And the idea was to help people to find a way into their life by helping them to orient themselves along to their personal meaning in the specific situations. With this, he wanted to create a counterweight to psychoanalysis. At that time, there existed only psychoanalysis and the individual psychology of Alfred Adler. Not even Jung has developed his theory. He was an adherent of Freud at that time. And he said, when we occupy ourselves and when we help people to find meaning, then we do work on the specific human. That's what makes the human being really human. It's not the consciousness, but it's the understanding of why I'm here. So we have a part of Sigmund Freud's understanding, human being, the characteristic of human being is the consciousness. We have another understanding, which is maybe a bit more concrete, the consciousness of what? Of to where am I going? For what do I have to live? For what do I have to carry all this suffering? And he brought that into psychotherapy. But we then found, and there were many more critics like Jaspers, Görres, and others who said that the logotherapy lacked especially the work on emotions. It was too cognitive, sometimes too dogmatic. He did not work with biography. He did not include psychodynamics. So it is difficult to do psychotherapy when these are not topics in the work. And logotherapy did not have an elaborated psychopathology, and no methods and techniques except paradoxical intention and the dereflection and maybe the Socratic dialogue. So this led to the development of existential analysis of nowadays. We have to develop a theory of emotions, and to include psychodynamics, psychopathology, a work with biography and with traumatic experiences, to develop methods and specific concepts for diagnosis. And so we say nowadays, from the point of view of existential analysis, logotherapy is a counseling, a preventive method. It's very helpful in pedagogics. But for therapy, it is not enough. In most cases, it's not enough to work with logotherapy. It's a part of existential procedures. Sometimes meaning questions arise, but most often people suffer from anxiety, from depression, from addiction, and the meaning question is somehow behind. And if we focus only meaning, we cannot really proceed in this work. And we say that existential analysis, in our understanding, is an analysis, a work on the conditions to come to a fulfilling life, to see what are the possibilities which we have, what we can do, what is open, where we can apply our freedom. Possibilities means I'm not forced to do it. I have to decide, I can find it, and to realize myself in my world. This is existence. And to do that, we can summarize this work by saying existential analysis, we can even define existential analysis with this term, tries to help people to live according to their inner consent to what they do or don't do. What does this mean? Inner consent. We sometimes use that word in everyday life. I cannot give my consent to your proposition, for instance. Then this means I cannot say yes. Inner consent is an inner yes. Inner consent is an approval. Is the feeling consent sentiment. It is not just a thought. It must go through my heart. It must be felt. Otherwise, when it is not felt, this yes, when it is just rational, cognitive, or so, logic, it's not existential. It's a thinking about existence, but it's not existence. Existence means that I'm fully present. And to be able to be fully present, this means I have to look into myself and to look and to listen what comes up in myself. I cannot determine what my inner heart, my inner feeling says. I have like an echo in myself. Every human being has that. One people have more access to it, other people have less access to it. It must be something which comes out of my essence. Then it is authentic. Then it is my life, which is not under my, sorry to say that in America, not under my control. It's a given. It's a gift. It's life's gift which comes up. I can control afterwards my behavior, my decisions, etc. But the origin is so deeply rooted that it is out of my control. It's much bigger than I am. This is something which in this circle is understandable. You are humanistic, you are existential, you know what I mean. In other environments, in psychology, it is hard to understand, because in a behavioral therapeutic approach, you must control your steps. this is somehow revolutionary to bring in the very human into psychology and psychotherapy. To live with inner consent. You can check it. You know, you feel if you have a consent to be here right now. You feel if it is still interesting enough, promising enough. You may have the feeling, well, I'd like to remain a bit more, to just listen. Or maybe you already got fed up with what you heard, that this is so stupid or so so normal. I know that it's better to go and have a coffee. Then you have not consented to be. But you may be very polite and say, well, I do not want to go out there. Because then you have a consent for politeness. But this is a form of consent. This is not really fulfilling. If we don't have consent to a content, then I'm not really present. When I'm not present, this is the term you use very often, present. When I'm not present, I'm not in the world. I'm not here. I'm not born again in this situation. So, it is something we do all the time. We do it not even consciously, to oppose a little bit Sigmund Freud. It is something which comes so spontaneously, I don't say automatically. Automatically is more functional. Spontaneously, this is a free emergence in me, something which comes up by itself. And this is me who I am grasping when I'm looking for my inner consent. When I'm looking, do I feel accordance? Do I feel okay? Do I feel yes to what I do? I'm sitting here and listening. Is it congruent with myself, Carl Rogers would say? I think this is very humanistic and existential. This is with inner consent we make use of our freedom. Consent is something which is free. I'm not forced. Nobody can give my consent except me. Nobody can force me to give a consent except me. Because I'm radically free, rooted in my essence. And nobody has access to my essence except, hopefully, me. It's not even sure that I have good access to my essence. And we have sometimes to work a lot on this. We know it when we work with our clients and patients. And in our trainings, how much it needs and that we can come to this deep root. And it's a lifelong work to become really more and more oneself. Being human is a process. Yeah. To come to inner consent, it needs two things. Access to the person, I make that a bit briefly, and the process needs to have structure to which we can rely. We have to find out the central themes of our life and to ask us with what do we have to deal if we want to come to a real, fulfilling life. These are the two pillars of existential analysis. This is now the structure of existential analysis. We have a model to process difficulties when we cannot digest an experience, when we are occupied by sorrows, by problems, by pain, hurtings, etc. Then we have to process this experience so that we can integrate it, that we can be with it, live with it, and take place or take our place with that pain when somebody is hurting me, when I'm offended by somebody, when I feel rejected, devaluated, etc. We have to process that through to become again ourselves. This is the dynamic part, where the power of the person is used, and this is done by personal existential analysis and phenomenological method, which we apply to work through these difficulties. Situations we do not understand, situations which are over-demanding in the moment, where we react with psychodynamic reactions, coping, defense mechanisms, etc. Here we apply the personal existential analysis. But on the other side, we have a structural model. Our existence has basic structures which we found by phenomenological work. Four basic structures which lead to the fundamental existential motivations. On this we are looking now. We look to the structural model. We cannot do everything tonight. Maybe we can speak a bit more about it on personal existential analysis tomorrow. I put an appendix on the PowerPoints. I will not show them tonight, but on the homepage you find an appendix a bit more about personal existential analysis. So, structural model is like when we see how people build a skyscraper, we see sometimes the steel
steel structure,
thank you. And there are no walls and nothing but just the structure. This is like this is an analogy to the structural model. And within these structures, our daily life happens. And these build the walls and the furniture and all this. And when there is something wrong, we apply the processional model to rearrange it and to build correct walls, etc. But the structure of existence, what is that like? The four fundamental motivations, the cornerstones of existence, are first, we are born into this world. We have to deal with a reality which does not follow our will, to which we have to subject ourselves. We have to follow the natural laws, otherwise we will not survive. Another reality which we cannot set aside is the fact that we are alive. We live. Biological life, psychic life. And life is something fluid, which grows, matures, becomes old, and is going to die. This is a structural framework of our life. Another fact which we can never avoid or step out is that I am always me throughout my life. I cannot be somebody else. I cannot separate from me. I'm going to bed with me and I'm standing up in the morning with me. And if the relationship with myself is not good, I can't even divorce. And this me needs the other person. So we need you and me. And life happens in a wider context. In a family, in a working place, with a past and a future. Wider contexts, several wider contexts, which are basic for developing of meaning. To deal with the world, what do we have to do? We need information about the world. about the physical world, the chemical world, the economic world, the social world, the political world, all these givens in which we are. We have to know how it functions, how it works. We must know how to start a car. Otherwise, we cannot deal with a car. And we must learn to ride a bicycle, to perceive how things work, how they are connected, what are the laws, the connections, the interactions. And not only what is given, but in the midst or in between the pillars which are given, like this ground is stable, I cannot change this ground, not so easily, not with my hand only, I need machines, I can open the ground here, but there are givens, but with these givens are open possibilities. I can do something with the given. The given is not a jail. The given is gives me an opportunity to deal with it. The ground gives me the opportunity to walk. If I weren't on the ground, if I were on water, I could not walk. Not yet. Yeah. So I have to perceive, we have to have cognition about where we are. So we have to learn facts. Science, technology, all this is situated in this dimension. Natural science is the investigation of the facts so that we can make use of it and make tools and machines and penicillin, etc. Life, totally different dimension of our existence. Life means that life happens in feelings. Without feelings, there is no life. Life means that we feel connected with things which we like, we call them values, which we find important, we call them values, or which are of the opposite, not values. Pain. But values are attractive. How can we find out what is attractive? By knowing. If I see an attractive woman, I know her hair is perfect, her face is perfect. I know, is this my knowing making her attractive? It would be a very poor life if attraction would only be knowledge, rationality. It needs feelings. And so values can be found out only, existentially relevant values, let's say that, to be philosophically correct. Such values which count for my life, we find them by feeling. We must be touched, moved. Otherwise, they are categories or concepts, but not values which matter for my life. For that, we need feelings. More, the next dimension. Being myself, what a difficult question. Who is me? How can I find out what is really me, and where I'm copying others, where I'm educated and obeying my parents after even 40, 50 years later, still obeying and doing what they want, what they trained me. Real me, I must sense it. I must have this openness towards myself and to undergo the risk that something comes up in me, some voice, some sensation, some feeling, some harmony or disharmony, which tells me this corresponds to you or not. And so I can find out only, I can find out who I am only by looking at the inner vibration. Very difficult. And we are not very much taught about this in our schools and often education. The wider context. This is the theme of how can I become more? How can I undergo a development? How can I bring myself into a richer context? Can I, when the context of my relationship is not good anymore, then I cannot concord with it. I have the feeling it's not worthy, it is meaningless, doesn't make sense anymore to continue this relationship. It leads to nothing, it leads to the pain again and again. And it would be masochistic to continue in such a case. So it's better to separate, for instance, or to continue when I see a future. When I see that this context is still valuable, then I'm ready to invest. So this is a bit abstract, but maybe we will have some chance to see a bit more how to find meaning. Meaning is a future-related connection. Meaning, therefore, gives me orientation. I hope it is still meaningful for you to listen. And if I continue, I promised Kirk, when you fall asleep, that I will stop talking. So I tell you frankly that this was our agreement, which we made before.
Keep talking about it.
Okay. Okay, this is... And you have an intuitive understanding what this meaning. Meaning means continue. This is future. Future which is valuable, which gives a value, which promises a value. Then it makes meaning. The result are these cornerstones of existence, just to give you an overview, forefrontal. With these elements are so basic that they are motivating us continuously, that we are able to be in this world, to live our life, to be ourselves, and to bring ourselves into a good context where it is worth living. And since these fundamental elements are so basic in our life, they are constantly motivating us, and therefore we call them the fundamental motivations of existence. In other words, to summarize, the relationship to the world means to be able to be there. To live our life means to look at what I like. These are practical accesses now, from breaking it down from the theory to practical psychological application. We are coming closer to that application by looking at what can you do, what do you like to do. And may you do that? Does it correspond to you? So that you can really be yourself. If I do things which I may not do, I'm losing myself, I'm alienating myself. But if I have the feeling that this corresponds, then I may do it, and I also should do it when I see a necessity, a requirement from the situation. And we can say, when all four dimensions come together, we have a holistic, well-based will. When I say I want, this means I can do it, I like it. It corresponds to me, I'm allowed to do that, I may do that, and I even should do that in that situation. And then this is a stable will. When people say, I have a weak will, one, at least one of these elements is lacking, are lacking. We can put them in that picture, which gives an overview. A table with four legs. I can, I like, I may, and I should. Sometimes even I ought to do. The requirement is calling me. Existence is based on these four pillars, or four legs. Then I exist. I don't have to explain you what existence is. You know that. This means to be really there in this world. My world now is this room with your with you being present. This is my world, actually. And this world is changing from situation to situation. To be really there. This means I can be here. I like it. This has a value. It corresponds to me. It is okay. I don't have a bad moral conscience when I'm continuing to speak to you. And it still has the requirement to continue. 20 more minutes, I think. Oh, 10 more minutes. Wow. Underneath are some prerequisites. I'm now going through that the four dimensions a bit more in detail, but I do it quickly. Just to give you, I invite you to hop on through a tour to the city. We are not walking through the city. In the tour we see, in 1 hour we see the whole city. And of course, we do not have a real understanding of this city. We get that more when we walk through the city. But you have a first impression of the city. The first dimension, this connection to the world, is this based or focusing the ability to be in this world. Can I be? This is a very basic question for the human being. Can I be there where I am? On this working place? In this relationship? In my family? In my body, who has arrhythmia, cardiac arrhythmia, or a cancer? Can I be with all the difficulties? Can I live with my pain? Can I just physically survive, emotionally survive? Can I be? A very existential question. To work on it, we can go deeper, and we see that I can has two connections. A connection to the own power. For instance, I can stand up in the morning, get up in the morning, when I am physically healthy, when I have 40 centigrade degree fever, this is, you understand me, when I have a high fever, I don't simply have the power, or when the leg is broken, I cannot. But it needs also an outer circumstances which allow me to get up. When there is no solid ground around my bed, then I cannot stand on it. Then I could not get up. I would have the power, but I cannot. Or I see a piano here. To play the piano means I need to have a piano in the world. But this does not mean that I am able to play it. So the two must come together for being able to. This is important in practice. When people say, I cannot do it. Why? Is it from the outside or from the inside? Don't you have the courage to do it? Don't you have the capacity? Or don't you have possibility, the favorable circumstances? When I cannot be here, then we have anxiety. And defense mechanisms start up. Avoidance, flight, or attacking, hate, aggression, benumbing, shock. Just to give you an idea. Practical work means we look at acceptance and endurance. To broaden the basis of existence, that the person can be better in this world, has more capacity to be in this world, in this his or her world, and circumstances. We have to see, is this person able to accept what is given? And if it is heavy, does this person have enough power to endure it? Because if this is not possible, they need protection. They need more space. They need support. So this gives you a glimpse into practical work, and this practical work goes quite deep. There are several stories we go down. And special activity is, of course, perception and cognition. We must deal with the facts to come to a good connection with the world. To be able to be there, central is the feeling, I can be there. Yes, we can. You know that. This is very American. You are great in that. This is a difference when I do seminars. Since years I am in Vancouver, and we have a society there. And when we work on this in the training, they all say, "I can always do something." In Europe, half of the group says, "I often cannot do what I want." What the difference in culture? Yeah. So this is really a strength in your culture here. And the connection with life, the connection with world and with the facts and with the possibilities, this is really strong here. The second dimension is the ability of relating, feeling my life. There is an extremely strong question referring to this dimension. I live, of course I know that I live, but do I personally, me personally, with my freedom, do I like to live this life, which is my life? I have no other life. At least in psychology and psychotherapy, we can work only on this life. Do I personally really like to live this life with all the hindrances and handicaps and limitations? Do I like them? Nobody can give the answer except me. If I don't give the answer, or if I deny this, then we come close to depression. Depression is the feeling, I really don't want to live. I don't like it. Life is difficult, hard, painful, dark, no future. Then we are depressed. Something totally different to anxiety. It is another dimension of existence. To make it quick, if we do not like to live this situation, this encounter, it does not always mean the whole life, of course, but ultimately it refers to the whole life. This deep feeling of life is good, this is the ultimate feeling, this is the level of spirituality, which is very vivid in your society, this level. But in many situations, it is the horizon is much smaller. And do I like to be here? Do I like to cook? Do I like etc.? And if I don't like to cook and I have to cook, then I'm regressing. I'm waiting. I try to do other things. If I feel too weak or not sufficient enough, then I try to achieve more and to be the better. And to these are coping reactions to overcome the feeling that life is not good. Depressive people help other people so much and exhaust themselves just to get a little bit of feeling that my life is good, that I can have an idea that I can like my life. Aggression is fury and resignation, the death feigning, the freezing reflex. When we confront difficult life situations, then we mourn. Mourning, grieving may be better, is when we have a loss of a value. When our relationship is separated, when we have a death of a person, and when we lose a job, for all values which we lose, we start naturally to grieve, to integrate it. And the basis on this work is, in the first dimension, it is acceptance. In this dimension, referring to life, it is turning towards, coming closer, to get touched. And this needs relationship, time, closeness. This is too much to explain all this the evening. And feeling and experiences is very, very basic for that. The third dimension, being myself. I am not automatically myself. Existential philosophy worked a lot on this. I decide who I am. I am always the one who is deciding. I'm not a fixed substance. Of course, my body is there, and maybe my mood is quite fixed the whole day. But who I really am is much more. And the question is, I am myself, but am I allowed to be as I am? When I'm with my partner, am I allowed to show myself my wishes, my needs, my longings, my pain, my dissatisfaction? Am I allowed? May I say that? May I entrust it? Or do I have to show a smiling face, to put on a mask, not allowing to be myself? A big question in our working life, in front of our clients, but also especially in front of myself. Do I really allow myself to see me as I am, as the one who I am, with my pain, with my needs, with my wishes, with my goals, my fears? This is a work which we have to apply to really gain ourselves, come closer to ourselves. If this does not happen, if we do not find ourselves, we come into hysteric reactions. Then we lose ourselves, we lose our boundaries, and we become objects of others. Coping reactions are going into distance, functioning or punishing the others, having anger or even dissociation and splitting. Confrontation means to look into the face of the other, and to face what the other is telling me, doing with me, to bring it up, to encounter it, to speak it up, to look into the other's eyes, to draw my borders, to be able to encounter. I must say, this is what I feel, what is important for me. It may be different for that word, different than what you feel important, to be important. But let us talk about it. Delimitation, drawing boundaries, does not mean that we are separated. We separate to be able to encounter. And when we are hurt, we can forgive. And when we did something wrong, then we regret that I shouted at you, that I spoke up too heavily, that I hurt you, and say sorry. Then I draw my boundary again and say, this is not who I am really. And therefore, I want you to know that I am different. And then the other can say, okay, then we can meet again. Prerequisites, it needs attention, justice, appreciation. The result is we come to self-image, authenticity. The last dimension, finding meaning. For what is it good? For what is it good to listen to this? It's good if I can apply it for my life, for my clients, if I can check this theory with the theory I have and see what is in parallel, what is different. Maybe I can take something, maybe I feel these differences, which makes it more clear to me how I will proceed. Then it is good for something, then something is developing, something new comes up. It is fertilizing, becomes fruitful. Frankl brought in this existential turn, which is very basic for finding meaning. He said, we have to make a turn of 180 degrees and instead of asking always, what do I want, what do I get, to let that aside and open up, phenomenologically, to the situation and let the situation ask me. Life is asking me. The situation is asking me. Life, what is this situation? What does this situation want from me? A bit more attention maybe for 3 more minutes, for instance. Or to bring up a question, or to raise a question or so. What does this situation want from me? That I follow or that I stop it? We are asked existence when it is turning around. The question of meaning is to give answer, to be open for the question of the situation. What does this cancer want from me, for instance? No will, and people become suicidal. When there is no meaning, the consequence is not psychopathology like anxiety in the first, or depression in the second, or hysteria and personality disorders in the third, but people withdraw from life. They don't want to continue. It doesn't make any sense to continue. And this means suicidality. Suicidality is not a sickness. Suicidality is a decision. On the basis, in all suicidalities, there is a lack of meaning. Or the meaning is to die, of course. We have coping reactions, provisional life, fanaticism, cynicism, fatalism. Confronting means tuning the situation with myself. Open up to the situation and let me ask and find out, does this correspond to me and to the requirement of the situation? It needs context, activity, value in the future, Just you see, there is a systematic. This is what I want to show you. This is not to be memorized. There is a striking structure behind this structural module. It's like the periodic system in chemistry. It has the same structure in all four dimensions with different contents in it. This was surprising when we found out this. To wind up the presentation, existential meaning, we understand it as the most valuable possibility of the given situation. So the existential meaning is the most valuable now is to come to an end. In this given situation, this is very practical, situational meaning. This is a strength of logotherapy, that they make this big issue of meaning, this big question, makes it very practical by breaking it down into a concrete situation. Because the big question of meaning, the ontological meaning, this is an area of philosophy. Of course we can philosophize. And this is the area of religion. Every religion gives you an answer on the meaning of life. The meaning of the being. But for a human being, the meaning of being we cannot know, because we didn't create the being. We didn't create even ourselves. So we can only break it down into the human dimension, which means, and what can I do good out of it? What can I contribute to a development? And this means commitment and to act. So let me close with the sentence of Viktor Frankl. He said once, life is not something, life is the chance for something. We all have a chance, even in the worst situations of our life. And to help people to find out their chance, I think this is a great task in our profession. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Alfred. Many stories, as you say, many layers to steep in with your reflections here. Would you be willing to take, let's say, 10 minutes for some questions, discussion?
Yes, I have a question.
Do you have another mic?
Yeah, the mic.
Need a mic?
Maybe not.
Okay, you spoke of the old logotherapy model and the new logotherapy model, and my question has to do with the new logotherapy model's view of freedom, and does it differ than the old model's view of freedom?
I wouldn't say that it differs. Logotherapy, we took it over from Frankl. We don't have very much renewed on the in the field of logotherapy. The three prerequisites, Frankl did not describe them. We have methods, etc. But in principle, Frankl's understanding of meaning and of freedom and the impact of moral conscience and all this, we follow them. We have more distinctions. But, for instance, Frankl said the moral conscience is the meaning-finding procedure or organ. He said, Sinnfindungsorgan, organ to find the meaning. The moral conscience. And we say, no, the moral conscience belongs to the third dimension of existence, to be really authentic, an authentic person. But meaning means to apply the personal capacity of being phenomenological and to deal with the situation in which we are. So we sense what is in the air, what is needed. And this is a little distinction from very specialized, you may know a lot about logotherapy that you ask this question, so this very special topic already. But in principle, freedom is the basis for meaning. Meaning which we, when we feel something is meaningful, this means we must feel free ourselves. When I'm forced, I have no subjective feeling of meaningfulness. I can say, theoretically, it's meaningful. I can say it's meaningful for my dad, for my mom, for my boss, but not for me, because I have to do it. And this would contradict to the human essence. The human essence is free, and if I cannot live my freedom, I will not be able to experience something as meaningful. So meaning, freedom is basic for meaning, as it was for Franklin. It's still now.
Well, I think the difference would be the emphasis on sensing.
Yeah.
I don't think Frankl was focused on sensing.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Frankl said, the moral conscience tells me if something is meaningful. But he did not describe a practical way how to find the moral conscience. And so he said, it's rational. So he had a cognitive understanding of meaning. And this is a main difference between logotherapy and existential analysis of nowadays.
And another quick question. You used the term inner vibration.
Yeah.
And I want to know what you mean by inner vibration.
When I'm touched, something is moving inside.
Resonate.
Resonance, right. Inner resonance. Emotions are resonances. Emotions are not thoughts. Emotions are much closer to the body, to the embodiment. And so, we cannot make emotions. We can only expose ourselves to objects or situations and open up and let us be touched. When we look a video or a movie or a sunset or a crying child or some painful situation, it is going to touch us. And this happens to us. But we can influence or control is to what we are looking, and if we are opening, but the rest happens to us.
Mm-hmm. First of all, your voice speaks to my heart. I love your presentation. I had some friends commit suicide in the last few years, and I wonder what a feeling, thinking person has to go through. And I read Frankl's book every day, a page or two every day. I think about meaning every day, but I also wonder what drives someone to finally commit suicide, have that great feeling of life, it seems, and then all of a sudden, permanent solution to a maybe temporary problem. What happens with someone that goes through that process?
When life comes into a dead end, what does person sees as being the dead end. There is no way out anymore. When there is no hope, when there is no future, when there is no meaning, when there is only suffering, when there is only pain, when there is only destruction and disappointment and deception and only negative perspective. It's very human to say, with my dignity, why should I undergo this? Why should I only suffer? I was offended, I was destroyed, I'm too much in the alcohol, I don't know. I have no more money, I have no more resources. People left me alone, my friends left me alone. Why should I continue? Why? I see nothing positive, no value. Tomorrow will be like today, maybe worse. Why should I continue? Can you empathize? Can you see? This can happen to us. Life of a human being is nothing guaranteed. There is no warranty. There is no security. It can happen that we fell very sick, that we feel that our life is over, that we feel that the values are destroyed. The most values, the most important values are relationships. And when people, friends, partners, leave me alone, and I'm at the edge, at the border of some of being able to be there, or cancer, and why should I undergo all this? I know what it will come, what will come up. And it does not make any meaning. It does not make sense. Because what makes sense always means that there is a value in the future. Something good is coming out. And if I don't see that, for instance, something good can come out by deepening my life, by deepening myself, by looking at my personal relationship to the fact that I have been born by a mother, that I had a family, etc. When I don't even have this basis within me, in my biography, it's even harder to trust that it may have some value to deepen my existence. And then it is understandable. People in depression, they lose their values. And it is a symptom of depression that people become suicidal. There is still a barrier. People don't do it so easily because somehow we feel this is a metaphysical act. We didn't give ourselves the life. We received it. How can we decide about our life? We have the capacity. Our freedom is so radical that we can decide about continuing or not.
Thanks.
On the relationship of freedom to meaning, I've noticed part of what you had in part of the presentation about meaning was about discovering the shoulds. Mm-hmm. I've always found it useful to help patients re-translate shoulds into wants, and that once you can help people do that through whatever kind of skillful questioning that and help the patient to experience what they want rather than a should. Karen Horney spoke of the tyranny of the shoulds, and that a should is an experience of an authority coming from outside oneself, in my experience. And so I wonder if you bring that into your work. Secondly, I had the experience 48 years ago of finding myself at lunch with Viktor Frankl at the Stanford Faculty Club. I was a resident along with my class. We had lunch with him. And I told him about a group I had formed on the inpatient unit at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. I called it a logotherapy group, had everybody, patients, staff, medical students, residents, all join that group if they felt like it. The focus of the group was to be on meaning of this experience in the hospital here together, and what meanings might we find. And I found that, and a lot of the patients found that very helpful, even people who were psychotic and suicidal and depressed. To focus on that experience in the hospital seemed very helpful within a context of discovering meanings in this experience. And he found that interesting. I don't know whether he's ever used
logotherapy approach of that sort in inpatient work at all, but perhaps you can comment on both these ideas.
Thank you. The should is a terrible word. I know I should finish now. And this is terrible. Kirk, what are you saying? Should I?
Is the should inner or outer?
Is it a want?
Yeah, it can, not yet. Want, you know, want is afterwards. For instance, I can go and buy shoes, and I like them, I can pay there for them, and they suit to me, and I may buy them, but maybe I shouldn't buy them, because I already have three pairs of the same color at home. Then it isn't in that context, it does not fit. This is the origin, the deeper understanding of should. Of course, we have parents who say, you should, and we have so many shoulds, and I should visit my mom, and I should write an email, and all these is a tyranny, as Karin Horney called it, and Max Scheler spoke about the tyranny of values, and the shoulds, etc. This, and for psychologists, it's very important to know that, and to be aware of that, and to deliberate or to free the should from this poignancy, from this coercion which can come along with the should. But in itself, in principle, we feel the request of the situation. This is, we can call it, now it's time to finish. And we can call that should. We don't have to use that word, I agree on that. And with some patients, clients, who had a very strong or severe education, it's difficult to talk about it. But they are mostly victims of the should. And then we should maybe problematize the should. So I agree with you what you say. We must be cautious and sensitive for the should. But in principle, should simply means something is waiting for me. From the being to the becoming. The step between that. We can call it should. Yeah. And it's fantastic you had a logotherapy group 40 years ago.
48 years.
I didn't want to exaggerate. So 40 years ago, yeah. So you're a pioneer here in California. You are a pioneer in California in yoga therapy.
Only briefly.
Briefly, yeah. But you gave it a try. Congratulations. Frankl himself did not make yoga therapy groups. He had just individual work with people. But there were many more people who did yoga therapy groups, especially in California. It was Joseph Fabry in Berkeley who did yoga therapy groups later on.
But I think what Steve was also asking was something about just the experience of being together as a creation of meaning.
Yeah.
Just that very fact of being together was already meaningful.
And the share. Yeah, and the sharing and the participating and empathizing in what other people say. This is meaningful.
It seemed to provide a context that allowed people to objectify perhaps their own suicidal feelings or even their psychosis.
So maybe we should from an inner place.
I don't have a question so much. First of all, I missed the first part because I just flew down from Vancouver. And I'm finding this all very interesting, but also quite academic, because I work with First Nations people in British Columbia, and there is a very high suicide rate amongst youth. And so I'm thinking about life is the chance for something, about freedom being the basis of meaning. And I'm thinking about this mental state that has to be experienced in a certain way that will help to a person to be open to find their meaning. When you have a high suicide rate amongst young people, it's not always it's kind of less, sort of less academic process to, that I find. I'm looking at them. Their meaning began in early childhood, where the attachment issues are so severe and so lacking that to find meaning in their later life or even in their teenage life is very almost impossible, because the basis of our existence, where we feel attached to somebody in a meaningful way, where we know, it's like I tell some of my young clients, it's like the mother bear and the baby bear needs to know who his mother is. And so when these children, and I work on reserves, and I see them, some of them, there's no food in the house, the parents, in one of the communities where I work, there's a very, an 80 to 90% addiction rate in the small community. And so this, the whole idea of this meaning is, in my opinion, it's about the attachment issues. And it's very difficult until one has resolved some of those attachment issues to be able to find meaning. And I also noticed that the state of mind is affected, because what they do is they drink alcohol. And then it's because one young person recently in the community committed suicide. She had friends over and they were drinking, and she just quietly went out to the bridge and hung herself. And so, but she had, there was nothing, there were her, and this was like a 13 or a 14 year old. So I guess I'm thinking about it in a different way, in a more practical way, and maybe psychologically, but less academic, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I think these are powerful questions, and maybe we'll require follow-up for those of you interested in the training tomorrow. I think a number of these questions could be answered more fully, but do you have a very brief, practical?
Yeah. This is something new in existential analysis compared to logotherapy in Frank. In existential analysis, we see meaning as the fourth step. Meaning is a late issue. Before meaning, we have to look at, can I be to the reality? If there's nothing to eat in the refrigerator, don't speak about meaning. To the relationship. If there is no friend, if there is no mother bear, don't speak about meaning, it's too early. If there is no encounter, no other person whom I can, who sees me, who cares for me, who is interested in me, don't speak about meaning. These are primordial issues. But when all this is there, the question may come up, and what for? And when they are getting drunk, I can ask them, in that case, I can ask them, do you think this is good for something that you get drunk? Is it meaningful? Do you have that feeling? And if he says yes, then I ask him why. And then we come to the trauma. And then we continue there. Thank you for this powerful work. And, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much again for giving us this very full meal around the topic of meaning. I found a great deal of meaning in your embodiment of these questions and these struggles. So I'm deeply appreciative of that, and for your stimulating comments about this. It feels like you've really whetted our appetites, at least mine, for much more. So Thank you deeply.
Thank you.
We now have a period of time for cocktails and